Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Those of you who were in attendance the last time this bill was heard heard some testimony from an attorney by the name of David Slater regarding the bill, and then myself and the governor's counsel, Mr. Lazenby, also testified. And in response to those concerns, Representative Shirley, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and I met with legislative counsel and also had some discussions with other practitioners and developed some amendments, hopefully responding to concerns by Mr. Slater. Those amendments are in work draft form, but presented to you today for hopeful conceptual adoption, and they are identified as the -A99 amendments. And you'll recall that one of the concerns, or the primary concern, that Mr. Slater raised about the version of 2985, which we passed over, which relates to vicarious liability and employment situations, was the concern that we had completely excluded the possibility of employers being liable for intentional torts to their employees. Mm-hmm. In response to that amendment, we prepared the -A99 amendments. But in Mr. Slater's testimony, which he provided after the hearing to me in writing, I want to read to you just a brief quote from Prosser on torts that I think highlights the issue that we're dealing with here. It says, even intentional torts may be so reasonably connected with the employment as to be within its scope, and the present tendency is to extend the employer's responsibility for such conduct. It may be said in general that the master is held liable for an intentional tort committed by the servant where its purpose, however misguided, is wholly or in part to further the master's business. Now, you'll remember, colleagues, that this provision arose out of two recent Supreme Court cases, the Ferry and Lorem cases, where, in my opinion, the Supreme Court extended the role of vicarious liability with respect to employers. In those situations, which were very, very tragic, you had a priest and a scoutmaster who had committed sexual assault against children. And with no evidence that the company or that the archdiocese or the scout organization had done anything wrong, those two cases decided that it was possible that intentional act was within the course and scope of the employment, and therefore that issue ought to go to the jury. I view that as an extension of vicarious liability law in Oregon, and I believe that the -A99 amendments to the original bill solve the concerns that were raised about essentially making a blanket indemnity for employers where there is an intentional tort. And we do it essentially by codifying in the statute the three-pronged test that Oregon has consistently used in scope of employment. And I refer to the CLE article on vicarious liability prepared by Nick Alexander, who you well know and works for the trial lawyers, and it's a very good piece. He identifies from the Gossett versus Simpson case the three-part test, which is the conduct of a servant is generally considered to be within the scope of employment if the conduct is, number one, is the kind that the person is employed to perform, two, occurs substantially within the authorized time and spacefulness, and three, is actuated at least in part by a purpose to serve the master. And obviously, that's the thing that I think in the Ferry and Lorem case where the distinction was made. What the court in that case said was that the so-called, I'm trying to remember the phraseology that these cases are using now, but the actions of getting close to this, to the child, as a scoutmaster and a priest, developing that trust relationship, were within the course and scope of employment. But it was at the moment where the individual went a step further and sexually abused the child that no one believes that the sexual abuse of the child constituted an act that was actuated at least in part by a purpose to serve the master. Where Ferry and Lorem, in my opinion, break new ground is they essentially allow that those acts, those non-tortious acts leading up to the tort, to be considered essentially tortious under the case analysis. So what we've done in the -A99 amendments is to incorporate that three-part test, but then also to add language that says and it's that last phrase after the comma that says, and a reasonably objective person engaging in the conduct would have believed that the conduct was for the benefit of the employer. So we've reinserted that benefit of the employer responsibility. We think that, for example, protects a situation where the bouncer, as was used as one of the examples, throws someone out of the bar but uses excessive force. Could the employer still be liable? And the answer is yes, because the bouncer could have reasonably believed the tort he was committing in exercising that intentional force was within the course and scope of his conduct and was, you know, believed to be for the benefit of the employer. But there is no way, no how, in a situation like in the Freeman and Warren cases, that the individuals in those cases could have believed that sexual assault was for the benefits of their employers. So we think this strikes an appropriate balance. We think we've been careful in our approach. I won't say that the governor's office is on board with this. I presented the amendment in this analysis to Mr. Lazenby yesterday. His response to me was that he was going to take it under advisement. But I would ask today, committee, that you adopt the dash A99 amendments in conceptual form, since we don't have a full LLC copy available. And with that, I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Questions, yes, Senator Brown.
Max, I received a letter from Kelly Clark on this issue. I don't know if you've had any conversations with him and whether your dash 99 amendments address his concerns.
I haven't. I think they probably come closer, but my suspicion is they don't. Kelly and I are both personal friends, and I think he's a good lawyer, and he came down and testified in the House committee, and I know, Senator Brown, you weren't here for the previous testimony when the bill was up. But the issue that Kelly and I have discussed, and it's really a policy issue, and I shared this with the committee the last time, and it's frankly probably better set out in the words of Nick Alexander in his article on vicarious liability than it is by me, but it basically says the doctrine has thus been described as one of strict liability based on the policy that an employer who receives the social and economic business or benefits of employing others must also be responsible for the acts of employees who are only acting in this fashion because of their employment. In a sense, the ultimate question is whether the loss resulting from a person's act should be borne by the business employing or otherwise associated with the person. Kelly's position is that in a situation, especially in these very traumatic sexual assault situations, that the person who committed the sexual assault is almost always judgment-proof. I mean, they're never going to have any kind of money. And so even though you've got an organization that has committed no wrongs, and we're not talking about a situation where they negligently hired or anything like that, because that's not covered here. If there was a negligent hiring or a negligent supervision or a failure to do background checks, they would still be liable under negligence law. But under strict vicarious liability, you could have an organization who had done everything right, and they would still be responsible under the Fearing and Warren cases for the damage done to the victim. And the question that Kelly and I posed to one another was, and I recognize that as compared to the individual, it may seem like you'd want to make the organization responsible, but the ultimate question is, how often do you make an organization who's done nothing wrong responsible for a bad actor until that organization fails to be able to perform the good things that it provides to society? And that's the balance that has to be struck here. And I believe that the Fearing and Warren cases went a little too far, and what I'm trying to do with the dash A99 amendments is put us back to a position that existed before Fearing and Warren. And my concern is twofold. One, I do think that we're going to see an expansion of this area, and I think we're already seeing it in employment cases. If I talk to employment lawyers around the state, where these are being impacted, I think that presents some serious problems. And it's very difficult when we have these sexual assault cases that are really heinous. But we've got to, frankly, and what I ask this committee to do is take a step back from the specific facts of the Fearing and Warren cases and consider this in the greater scheme of vicarious liability and employment law as a whole.
Other questions, Mr. Quinn? The addition of FELEA articles written by me.
And it's a very good one. I mean, I read it over. I took it home over the weekend because this is an area of law that I'm practiced in, and I needed to bone up a little bit. So it's unfortunate I just don't get any CLE credit for it.
Didn't the bill die on the House floor?
Yeah, Senator Brown, indeed it did.
I think it passed the Senate.
Yes, it did. I recall.
Thank you. If you could provide some copies of that CLE article. I don't know, have you already given copies of the two cases?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether or not the committee has received them. I'd be happy to make sure the committee receives both copies of the cases and Mr. Alexander's CLE article.
Thank you. We are in work session, and we have before us draft A99, and as they say the word draft on them, we can only adopt them conceptually. So the chair would move the conceptual adoption of the draft E99 amendments to House Bill 2985. Is there a discussion? Objection? The chair then would move House Bill 2985 to the floor as amended with a few past recommendations.
Can you hold off for a minute?
Okay.
This is a Senator Burdick.
Okay. You want to do a minority?
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we allow, do the vote.
Okay.
Send it back. You serve notice.
Okay.
Senator Burdick.
All right.
We'll work it out.
Thank you.
Are there objections? Please note Senator Brown is objecting. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill, and Senator Brown serves notice on a possible minority report. And Senator Burdick comes back. We'll give him that opportunity.
Thank you. I know that we have not had the opportunity to hear minority report discussion like they have on the House, so I would take advantage of this.
Our committee was complimented on that because the number of bills we handled, we're now close to 500, and the number of bills we passed out, that we have not had a minority report yet.
So you know, right there?
Maybe.
Yes, that's right. And twice they were...
Democrat, this bill doesn't work at all.
They work.
Sure, I really wanted to amend this. I wanted to get to A100.
Oh, the A100. We'll have to go to the conference committee for that. Senator Burdick, would you like to join the Senator Brown in serving notice of a possible minority report? And please record Senator Burdick as a no. So ordered. We'll close in the work session. And let's go to the tobacco bill, which is
3492.
Okay. The chair would move to suspend the rules on the possibility of reconsidering House Bill 3492. Is there objection? Discussion? I guess. Objection. First hearing, then. Sorry, Senator. My agenda.
It's just a bad day. Kind of there, though. So this is an important bill.
Chair then would like us to reconsider our vote by which we sent this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The purpose of this is twofold. We have some amendments from the Attorney General's office that put the bill in compliance with the Sinar Amendment. The Sinar Amendment is a federal action, and if you don't follow the federal law on this, you could lose federal funding. And then secondly, there are some witnesses that want to appear and testify on the -A10 amendments, and I want to extend my courtesy to them. And then thirdly, I had conversations with the Attorney General yesterday. He was concerned about the -A10 amendments as far as the effect on the offender and wanted to discuss more of a graduated sanction before you go to the act of suspending a driver's license. He thought that would be more productive and curbing the behavior create less rebellion and have a better law. So I told him last night when he called from Opryland, that's the National Attorney General's meeting in Nashville, Tennessee.
NAG,
that's right. I give it, that's the national organization of Attorney Generals, it's called NAG. That I give him that opportunity. So my purpose is to take testimony, make the amendment, and then hold the bill until the Attorney General returns on Monday. Is there any objection to reconsidering the vote and bringing the bill back for us? Hearing none, so ordered. Mr. Gardner. We are now in work session.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General. I'm here today to present the A-12 amendments to you. These are basically the A-10s with the added language in subsection 5, which is on page 2, starting at line 3, that allows the sign our compliance checks, also would allow retailers who have in-house secret shopper programs that use minors, and also would allow, I guess, the Costco rewards program where they send out minors to attempt to purchase cigarettes, and then when the retailers do not sell, send them a letter basically saying you've done a good job in enforcing the law. It would allow those kinds of use of minors under the supervision of an adult to continue and not be violation of the law. The Attorney General's position, I guess, has been articulated by the chairman. We would, at a minimum, like to have the A-12 amendments adopted by the committee. We think that would make the bill workable, and we would be willing to try to facilitate a meeting between people in the public health community, law enforcement, the retailers in the tobacco industry to try to work out a plan of graduate sanctions to bring back to the committee in terms of future amendments. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
And have you, Mark, reviewed the A-12 amendments with the proponents of the A-10 amendments to see that you're in agreement on that?
Yesterday, we had a draft, which is, I think, almost word for word as this, and that was circulated to all the members of the Gray Marketing Group, which included those people, and I did not hear anyone that had any objection to them.
Mr. Nelson, are you, as a proponent of the A-10, do you have any objection to the A-12?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, representing 7-Eleven. No, we have no objection to the A-12. We do believe it's the issue is covered by existing statute, but I think this clearly makes it workable, and I think protects those types of things that are taking place voluntarily.
We also have some A-11. And do we know where the A-11 came from?
A-11, Mr. Gardner brought forward, I believe some of the distributors expressed concerns to him about the original bill.
The A-11 we don't need.
No, the A-11 to provide notice to the distributors with regard to destruction and sale of cigarettes.
Mr. Chairman, I thought the A-11s had been adopted by the committee. That was when I was here on Tuesday in the bill. We adopted them, they moved out,
yes.
And then the A-10, they came back and the A-10s were adopted.
Yes, correct. Now that you've reached the vote for which you passed the bill out, you would need to readopt them.
Need to readopt them. Okay, thank you. Are there questions on the A-11s and A-12s before we get into the other testimony?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I just want to double check that the A-12, the language for the stinging protection, is the same as it is under the alcohol statute.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I'm not exactly aware of what the protection is under the alcohol statute, but I haven't researched that, so I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, to my knowledge, there are no specific statutory authorization for stings on the alcohol side. The authorization for stings on the tobacco side, I think, occurred in 1993 and authorizes random inspections, which have been construed to include stings.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I think that we may be protecting statute, but the Attorney General's language on page 2, I think, makes it absolutely clear that people participating in these types of things, children, minors, would not come under the prohibition against attempting to purchase.
Okay, thank you.
Are there questions? If not, the chair then would move adoption of, first of all, the Dash A11 amendments to House Bill 3492. These are the amendments we adopted before, but since we're reconsidering, we need to do that again. If there are discussion, objections, delivered. And do we need to also re-adopt the Dash 10 since we are reconsidering the vote?
Chair, I would urge this. Now, the Attorney General also called me, which I actually talked to you, and those amendments were shared with just about every Attorney General that was at this conference. And I don't want to begin to tell you what their reaction was. And those 10 amendments, for what it's worth, are a great concern, not only to our Attorney General, but to a number of other Attorney Generals across this nation. And so I really hope that you're not going to have to adopt those Dash 10 amendments until the Attorney General of the State of Oregon comes back and testifies on. And I don't know why the amendment we just adopted speaks to a specific thing this game. I don't know why we need to adopt the Dash 10 until we hear from our Attorney General.
Well, my hope was that we could go ahead and adopt them and hold the bill. With the 12 amendments there, but
well, I just shared with you, you're going to do what you're going to do. He shared with me, if we could get the 10 amendments out of the bill, they ought to come out of the bill. And now I realize you may have a different opinion with him. I know you're going to hold the bill, but he comes here. I don't know why we can't wait. You can always adopt him second after he comes here, even if you disagree with him. I don't think you should adopt that. I can't support, if you have the votes, you got the votes. I can't support the adoption of that 10 amendments to do the conversation I held with the Attorney General. I asked Mary by phone, I guess she says it's national, in the international conference. Okay.
We do have one other witness that wanted to address the Dash 10. Why don't we talk to or invite Ellie Hall from the Department of Health to come forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So the Dash 12, they're just like the Dash 10, except for the same protection, right?
That's the idea.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Eleanor Hall. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Health Division. And I'm here to testify regarding the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 3492, which would prohibit youth from attempting to purchase tobacco. The Health Division is opposed to the Dash 10 amendments for two reasons. First, they do not provide an exemption for participating in compliance checks. I understand you're addressing this issue now, and we're very glad to see that. Because, as you know, federal law does require the state to conduct compliance checks of a statistically valid sample of retailers each year to determine the extent to which tobacco is sold to minors. And unless we can carry out these checks, there's a chance that the state would lose its alcohol and drug block grants, which would be a terrible disaster for alcohol and drug treatment. We are also concerned about the Dash 10 amendments for another reason, though. We think that they hold children responsible for attempting to purchase tobacco in a partial and unbalanced manner. If children are liable for purchasing tobacco as this bill provides, they will join retail clerks who are already liable by Oregon statute for selling tobacco to minors. But they leave out a very important group from sharing this responsibility, and that is the retail owners themselves. There is no Oregon statute that holds owners of retail establishments liable for sales of tobacco to minors, even though this is an illegal activity. This is in real contrast to our alcohol statutes, which do hold the owners of retail establishments responsible for the activities of their clerks. We do think there is a real problem with retail tobacco sales to minors in Oregon. According to the last SINAR compliance data, 30% of retail establishments sold tobacco to minors. This was an increase from 24% the previous year, so we're not going in the right direction with this. We think this really underestimates the sale of tobacco to minors. When we do student surveys, 41% of the youth smokers report that they purchased tobacco from retailers in the past month. And of those who purchased, 57% said they were sold to that tobacco every time. So there is something wrong with our system of trying to keep kids under 18 from buying tobacco. We know there are many conscientious retailers throughout Oregon who believe that selling tobacco to minors is wrong. These are retailers who place tobacco behind the counters, who check ID, who have a policy of refusing to sell, who have training programs in place with their clerks, and enforce their no-sale policy. Unfortunately, not all retailers are as conscientious as evidenced by the compliance check and student survey results. 70% of Oregonians, adults, believe that it is easy for youth to purchase tobacco in their communities. And that's in real contrast to 97% of them who say it's really important to keep kids from being able to purchase. So the Health Division joins these other Oregonians and you in wanting to try to solve the problem of keeping stores from selling tobacco to minors. We think it's important that there be three-way responsibility, the retailers, the kids, and the clerks. When we have all three parties being held responsible, we think maybe we'll see some real change. So we would support a balanced approach, and we would look forward to working with the Attorney General and other people who support the Dash 10 to try to achieve that.
Thank you. Do you think the Dash 10 would have an effect on minors who try to purchase cigarettes if they risk losing their driving privileges?
Chair Bryant, you know, currently it is illegal for minors to be in possession of tobacco. So this would move up the violation by about 30 seconds.
But I guess to me, the advantage is normally driving privileges are very near and dear to
a
teenager's heart.
Do you think that
the risk of that, or when they hear that a friend has lost their driving privileges, there'd be an impact?
I think there is a possibility that this would be more meaningful to young people than the current violation. The fear we have is that if the courts see this as overly harsh and punitive, they won't impose any penalty. And if the law enforcement people see this as overly harsh and punitive, they also won't. So if we make it punishment too far disparate from the crime, we may actually see less enforcement rather than more enforcement. I think a year is a long time to suspend driving privileges, given that 30% of the young people under 18 are smoking. We could potentially create a lot of people who don't have driver's licenses.
That's of course, any punishment on any crime, part of it is deterrent. And in this case, it would be, as they're now proposing, mandatory. So the judge would have to some extent, and there wouldn't be any discretion. Don't you think that would have some effect on reducing the risk?
Well, I think the concept behind the deterrent is people have to feel it is certain and sure. And right now, the violation for being in possession of tobacco is so universally not enforced. I don't know whether this would become enforced. Would there be a mechanism whereby this would be enforced, whereas possession is not enforced?
Well, if they were cited, the way it's written right now, the judge would have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have to suspend, or she would have to suspend for some period.
Well, currently they're not being cited for possession, and I'm not sure that they would be cited for trying to buy either.
But supposing they were, would that be a deterrent?
Well, I believe that kids are very concerned about their driver's licenses. Yes, I do.
Part of the problem is with law enforcement inciting.
Yes, and committee member Jen Sherbrand, I think there's some concern about whether kids will, if we put a lot of pressure on punishing kids, many oftentimes they're smoking because they are interested in rebelling from adult standards anyway. And the Health Division, in trying to reduce youth smoking, has tried to tell kids that it's they're being manipulated, that they're being controlled by somebody else, as opposed to saying, this is your chance to be free and rebel against society. But I have not seen a lot of effective evidence that heavy enforcement of kids makes a big difference in other areas. But I do support a balanced approach, and I don't think it's fair to the clerks and the retailers responsible and not the kids. But currently, we don't hold the retailers responsible, and that's really different from the rest of our law, like workers' comp, where we say the owners of the job site are responsible for the behavior of the workers.
But it doesn't sound like we're holding the youth accountable either under our current law.
Police just
don't like to cite a minor offense to the youth in possession or smoking. Is that your experience?
My experience is they don't see this as a prioritizer. Well, we do have tobacco coalitions in every county that are trying to involve law enforcement in reducing sales to minors. And we are trying to involve police in both looking at sites where tobacco is widely sold and where everybody knows it's wide open and kids can get tobacco, and trying to get the police to be involved in that, as well as in participating in any sting and rewarding reminder systems.
In your coalitions and in your work with police, if you have a law where they can say to a young offender, you're going to lose your driver's license, don't you think that would have some impact? On some, anyway. I mean, why take the risk?
Chair Brown, I think where kids are maybe just experimenting and the younger kids are looking to buy, it might. But I think once people get addicted, as we've seen in the illegal drug activity, the ability of losing their freedom for years sometimes does not deter them from participating in using illegal drugs. And kids who've been smoking and buying their tobacco, I think it would have to be a very certain and sure penalty to really deter them. Often when younger kids start smoking, they don't go in and buy the first time. They'll steal it from their parents, or an older person will buy it for them, either legally or illegally.
Or shoplifting.
Or they shoplift, yes. So they simply think we can reduce youth smoking through penalizing kids for buying is probably still only a partial.
I agree, it's just a partial, but it's an arrow we can have in our quiver that we don't have right now. I don't know whether it's effective or not. I don't know if other states have tried it. But I do know it has been effective on drug and alcohol issues.
Chair Brown, committee members, I assure you we will work on this and try to come back to you with more research and evidence to let you be able to consider this more fully.
Thank you. Senator Brown. Representing Bauman.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, State Representative from District 19 in Northeast Portland. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3492, and I've just had an opportunity to review the A-10 amendment. And I'm speaking in opposition to it not because I don't believe we need to do everything in our power to make sure young people don't start smoking and don't incur that kind of health risk at a young age. I'm in opposition because we continue to criminalize youthful behavior that if, in fact, we did an early intervention that did not include suspending their driver's license, it could have more of an impact. All we will do by taking a young person's driver's license is now make them drive without a driver's license. It's not going to stop young people from getting behind the wheel of a car. All it's going to do now is make them another type of criminal. And so we continue to create avenues to label young people criminal offenders, and then we continue to enhance the penalties so that once they get into that system, they're there. And I think that we're taking the wrong approach. I really appreciate Oregon Health Department's work in reducing teen smoking, and I think they've done a phenomenal job. We have to continue to ask our question, why are young people not cited when a law enforcement officer sees them smoking a cigarette? I mean, that should take place. That citation should go to their home. Their parents should know that they've been cited for smoking tobacco products. And if that's not happening, then I think that that's a more appropriate way to address the issue initially before we start creating such significant penalties that we will make young people have no choice but to become criminals or more criminal to do the things that young people are going to do as part of their process of becoming adults. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you letting me come.
And you're always welcome to point out the Dash 10 and 12 do not make it criminal. I understand your point is that by driving without a license later on, it could become criminal.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. My logic is that if, in fact, we tell that young person the penalty is we will take your driver's license for 1 year, we have to ask ourselves, do you really think that that young person is not going to drive for 1 year? And I suspect that the answer is no. That young person will continue to drive until they're stopped again, and now they're a young person who's driving on a suspended license. And so what we've created is this catch-22, especially in rural areas where if you don't have a driver's license and you can't drive, then you can't socialize at all. And I just don't think it's realistic to say that if the penalty is taking a driver's license for a year, that we have an expectation that that young person will not get behind a wheel with that car.
But if the penalty, I think the way it could read easily is, you know, that would be a graduated sanction and you could lose your license up to a year.
Mm-hmm.
It might only be suspended for a month initial time. But if that had an effect of reducing teen smoking by 20 or 30%,
mm-hmm.
say that would be worthwhile?
Mr. Chair, I think anything that we can do other than criminalizing behavior to reduce teen smoking, I think would be effective. I think what you've heard and the committee members have heard is that the current laws on the book, which is to issue a ticket, a citation, we are not doing that. And so the question becomes, do we create the sanction on that young person, enhance that sanction, versus actually following the laws that currently exist on our books?
I have a question for Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chairman, I gather by your testimony that you're not opposing the underlying bill, that you're opposing the A-10 amendments, which invoke the penalties.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still trying to, your comment just a moment ago, if you gave the judge some options of the 1 month and that graduate kind of a thing, and I'm still thinking, Representative Bowman still opposes that concept. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, that's correct, because whether it's 30 days that you take that young person's driver's license or whether it's a year that you take that young person's driver's license, I don't think that we could in good consciousness believe that if that young person has had access to an automobile, is accustomed to driving, that they're going to give up that privilege just because the court has now said, you know, you've been a bad kid, and therefore we're going to take your driver's license for this period of time. I mean, and the reason I say that, Senator, is because it doesn't work with adults. I mean, when we suspend adult driver's license, we continue to arrest people, and now they have a higher sanction because now they're driving on a suspended license.
Mr. Chair, I think that was a comment I was making maybe before yesterday or so, too, when we were talking about it. My concern is that they will drive,
mm-hmm.
and even if you forget the fact that they're going to get arrested and so forth, but they're also becoming an uninsured driver.
That's correct.
And if it hits you, so I don't know. I haven't looked at the question. Is your comment just when we go covered in here, would that have to be added?
Yeah.
I really like that. I could support that much better than I could the other. I'd like to have a judge have some leeway, and there's a point where a judge would have to have some discretion whether or not that,
mm-hmm.
how that student's going to, or that student, that young person's going to operate. I'm concerned about a year. My guess is they will drive.
Thank you, committee.
Well, and ultimately,
it might deter some too from doing it.
Right.
And
of course, if they continue to drive, they get in trouble, and ultimately they're subject to forfeiture of the car they're driving. So we know at least in the alcohol and the drug area, that has some deterrence.
That's right. Your modification.
I guess, Mr. Chair, just to add on to Senator Duncan's concerns, I guess for those of us sitting in Portland, it's not a huge issue not to have a car, but my experience is at least the time I've spent in Enterprise that it's pretty hard to get anywhere except Safeway without a vehicle. So it certainly would have a disproportionate impact on rural Oregon, and I know how we hate to.
You can tell, Mr. Chair, that Enterprise is a major city because of our rural counseling had a safer stuff.
All right. We will then close the work session on House Bill 3492. We'll open a work session now on HAR 52, Representative Patrick. And also, Mr. Nelson Berlinden, who would like to come forward? committee, we did 2 days of hearings on HJR 52 and HJR 2. Polling the committee, HJR 52 had, of course, the best one that's been rescheduled. We have before us dash A8 and A9. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
I also see some now make it. All right. The A8 and 9 come from Mr. Pedanke, the American Civil Liberties Union. So, and then we have the A15. Why don't we allow the witnesses to discuss all three? And why don't we begin with Ms. Representative Passage?
Mr. Chair, as I look up, much as I respect the fellows that are from us, none of them looking into the ACLU, and I'm hopeful that we can include the ACLU.
Oh, we certainly will.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the A8, as you have heard previously, the specification is notwithstanding Section 8 of Article 1 would be to specify that the authority conferred by this resolution would be to allow local zoning of the sexually oriented businesses as permitted in the federal constitution, because Oregon's free speech provisions have been interpreted to bar such zoning in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, as the proponent of the bill, I'm in agreement with the A8 amendment in this, and have communicated that with the ACLU.
I imagine Mr. Linden is also.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Entertainment Corporation, the answer is yes.
You might as well identify
yourself. For the record, Andrea Myers, ACLU of Oregon.
And for the record, State Representative Rob Patrick House, 50 Medford.
Why don't we then turn to the A9 amendment and the units also?
These are our amendments, Chair, and we would rather have discussed the A15 and grandfathering language, and these are only necessary, I think, after that discussion.
Right.
These are intended to set the election later.
Let us go to the A15s then. Maybe the Chair just saw these for the first time this morning, too, so... So why don't we have Mr. Linden explain these things they come from you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A15s do two things. They make it clear that existing businesses would be grandfathered in under this HJR. And that is necessary because there is a reasonable expectation that many of these businesses would in fact be targeted for relocation if this measure were to pass next year or at the election. So the grandfathering clause simply states that existing businesses are going to be able to remain in business. Section 3 of the dash 15 is language that provides that if one of these businesses discontinues its use for a period of time, and we put 2 years in here, which is pretty standard, that non-conforming use would no longer be available to this type of business. And we think that's necessary so that you don't get into a situation where you have a sexually oriented business, an adult business, they stop operation for a couple of years, they want to come back, they're a non-conforming use, they want to reopen. We think that the cities ought to have the flexibility after an abandonment period like that to prevent the non-conforming use from continuing. And I think that's consistent with the way the law would be applied to any business today. So we think Section 3 is necessary so that you're not carving out a special exception or exemption for these types of businesses when you've had an abandonment of the nonconforming use. So simply to restate, the primary intent of this amendment is to provide that the existing businesses will be able to stay in business at the locations in which they're at. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The selection of 2 years I imagine whether or not you're continuing your non-conforming use currently is a matter of fact and determined by the court. Is there a case that says 2 years is the norm, or how is the 2 years arrived at?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's a case out of Multnomah County that sets a 2 year standard in terms of abandoning a non-conforming use. I don't have the citation on that, but we certainly could provide that to the committee.
The other concern is this does not change in any way the prohibition against expansion of a non-conforming, or if a business burns down, that if it isn't already conforming, you don't have the right to go ahead and rebuild. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Senator Brown, did you have a
question? I just lost it entirely. Go on to somebody else. Maybe I'll remember it.
Yes, Senator Birdie.
If the business changes hands, then what happens to the grandfather? They sell it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the mere act of a business change in ownership would not cause the non-conforming use to expire. And that is consistent with current law in terms of how non-conforming uses are treated. But in the House, there was quite a bit of discussion about this issue of abandonment, and that's why this language is here, to specifically provide that when you have that type of situation, that the city's hands are not tied from requiring that non-conforming use to become a conforming use.
Captain Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. We support the dash A15, and the rationale is that pre-existing businesses that came into Oregon that were lawful when they did should be treated the same. And what paragraph 3 does is set up so that these businesses, when they become non-conforming, are treated the same as other non-conforming businesses. Not better, not worse. And we believe strongly that language needs to be in there, because to not have it in there may set up the opportunity for cities and counties to then treat sexually oriented businesses that came in lawfully, that are now non-conforming use, differently and worse than other businesses that are non-conforming use. We want to ensure that the standard is set and that fairness continues after the vote.
Mr. Chair, you're talking about the fairness. I'm just concerned because there's a discussion going on as we're coming in about this, that this really creates a special, I think the reference was with land use planning, so this would be a special tier almost. It would be only to this related business. How do you address that particular concern?
Chair Bryant, Senator Duncan, I'm not sure that I believe that in Multnomah County, the way they treat non-conforming use businesses once they go into non-conforming use is the 2 year discontinuation period currently. So we are actually, what our attempt is not to set up sensibly a third tier, a separate tier. We're complying with non-conforming use for all businesses. We want to protect so that they don't establish another tier for non-conforming sexually oriented businesses and somehow start treating them differently than other non-conforming businesses.
We're doing a lot of two.
Was one of the issues, too, that, as I recall, the testimony from Portland, from the city of Portland, that on a non-conforming use, or if this were to pass, that they would somehow amortize the business loss and try to buy out the business over a period of time? Does the committee remember that testimony?
Yes. It was a process for, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a process for getting a business out of a location, a non-conforming business, short of the 2 year lag. In other words, once they had amortized their investment, or they could be compensated for their unamortized investment, then they could demand that they cease operating.
Amortization is a technique for forcing a non-conforming use out of a location, and there have been amortization ordinances of as little as 6 months that have been upheld in other states. And so that is another concern. There is another method in which these businesses could be shoved out of a location. And again, the intent of the A15 is to prevent that from occurring to existing businesses that came in here and lawfully set up these particular types of businesses.
Representative Packers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to come to the committee with a couple of things. I'm a little, we looked at these issues in late April on the House side. We had an opportunity to respond to amendments like these. Although I'm an attorney, I am not a land use attorney. Ms. Wessel is on vacation. No amendments up until this morning have been presented to me in any fashion in this regard. They knew that there were substantial concerns about these. I have two memorandums from Mel and Wessel, which I'd like to read from, as well as share with you a LC opinion that I received from Greg Chamoff this morning in regards to this. First, I'd like to address the amortization issue. I'm going to give copies of this to the committee as well as the individuals who are here this morning. I just got these this morning, so I apologize, Mr. Chair. In regards to amortization versus the in regards to amortization of existing businesses versus non-conforming use, those are two totally separate areas of the law. Amortization law is subject to federal takings provision under the federal constitution as well as state constitution. And the case law on that, as you can see by the legislative council opinion, depends on varying factors. Also, legislative council, I had them review in over a short period of time, but I asked them for this opinion. The most common period of amortization for these types of businesses in the United States that have been upheld by courts, it has been about 3 years. Amortization is something that's used not only for sexually oriented businesses, but for other types of businesses, especially when cities and counties try and do things like urban renewal districts where they're going to come in and revitalize a certain area of the city where they might purchase these businesses, homes, or other things across the country. I believe that under this proposed A15 amendment, especially the lines 4 and 5 of the A15 amendment, this section does not apply to sexually oriented business that is in existence in the state on the date that the people adopt this section. What it means is the two are tied together between a non-conforming use and amortization. What a non-conforming use does is it allows currently, for example, if you had a commercial or industrial area of a city that now you were looking for example, in Portland or other metropolitan areas, typically some kind of infill, or you were going to do some kind of urban renewal piece like you did maybe on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland or one of those areas. You could come in and rezone part of that area, maybe as residential. You could, and under the House Grant Resolution 52, you could also include the zoning for sexual-oriented businesses, depending on how that happened. Under the proposed amendments to HGR 52, the -A15 amendments, you'd be creating a total second tier, so you couldn't do anything about those businesses that existed in those areas for non-conforming use. So it does create an entire second tier that you deal with. In addition to creating that tier of how you zone businesses, you also are creating a difficulty in regulating these types of businesses from those that occurred before the amendment passed and how do you go about proving those and those types of things to those businesses that are in existence after they pass. It creates a substantial burden on cities, counties, and other political subdivisions that are subject to these types of zoning regulations. I believe that there is current law that is available to either this committee through Oregon statutes with the Article 1, Section 8 change by statute if you're concerned about it, but I don't believe that these are appropriate place. This is an appropriate vehicle, a constitutional amendment, to deal with this. Oregon's land use laws stem out of Oregon's Constitution. We can deal with amortization schedules by statute set up at a state level if we choose to do that. we can do it by other ways, but the Constitution is not the appropriate vehicle to do this. It doesn't allow the flexibility and the change in times to be able to do this. This simply allows zoning, to allow the court to look at the merits of the case under some kind of amortization scheme. It also allows the merits of the case to look at under a non-conforming use scheme. Cities and counties need to have this ability to be able to zone, things as a non-conforming use, and there is no evidence in any record whatsoever that these types of businesses are going to be targeted.
But if you wanted to rezone, if you wanted to buy the property of the city, you could do that. You said they condemn. This doesn't affect your ability to condemn.
This bill doesn't affect your ability to condemn, which is the same thing as an amortization, so they have to pay a fair market value. And what I'm saying is, why shouldn't...
I don't think it's the same as an amortization, because the considerations that are outlined in this Amos memo dealing with this are amortization is different than what happens in a condemnation proceeding. You don't consider the public benefit for elimination of the use in arriving at a value under condemnation.
But you have to arrive at a fair market value, Mr. Chair, under a condemnation or under an amortization schedule that can be determined by the court.
Right, but this allows deduction for the fair market value for the public benefit from the elimination of the use. That is not a consideration of condemnation. So it takes away from the value of the property.
I think that, I guess I would urge you to look at the cases that are out there on the amortization, because I don't think that that's a fair representation of that opinion.
I really appreciate all the incredible hard work you've done on this, and I guess my question is more of a political one. I can't remember the two prior ballot measures that failed to address this issue. Was it about measure 19 and now it's 31?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. I need a new life. it's my understanding that having some type of grandparenting clause in this proposal will change the opponents who are out there, change the dynamic in terms of who opposes the measure. I guess what I would ask you is, aren't we better off having something as opposed to nothing, given that the two ballot measures on this issue have already failed?
I will tell you, Senator Brown, that the proponents will probably fall off this bill if you create a whole second tier of land use for this regulation. If you choose to do these amendments, it will effectively kill the ability for a lot of cities and others to do it, where you're creating a whole second tier of land use. There's been no demonstrated evidence in Oregon or across the country to try and close these types of businesses down.
Portland came in and testified that they could amortize out these businesses, I think, and the testimony was...
They said they probably would.
It was in 1 or 2 years.
That's... Malin Wessel's here from the city of Portland. Malin Wessel's not here from the city of Portland. Marge Kaforia is here from the city of Portland. In conversations with her and in her speaking with her chief legal counsel in Portland from Portland City Attorney's Office, there has never been any discussion about amortization of these types of businesses. Ever. I think the question was posed last time, though I was not here, whether they could amortize, and they could amortize, and that is a correct statement of the facts if this were allowed, but you're not creating a second tier because of this.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I've misunderstood, but I thought I heard Ms. Wessel say that they would anticipate having an ordinance in place. Now, they didn't specifically say how that would be used, but that was how I interpreted her testimony.
I can't say that I was here. I'd be happy to review the records. I'd also like to share some other items with you, Senator, just in terms of what the case law is and what's going on.
Before you get to Mr.
Chair,
can I ask a question for Mr. Linden or whoever else about the abandonment issue? And that is, having dealt with the opening and closing of gravel pits, are these particular types of businesses, do they regularly go open and close within a 2-year period, or is that just a...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, there are market forces that relate directly to these types of businesses, and they open and close or change the type of entertainment they're offering on a very regular basis. I saw a list that was provided by Dave Sedanke that some 45 sexually oriented businesses since 1987 have either gone out of business, have either changed the type of business they were in. It's not uncommon at all to see these businesses go under for economic reasons.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can cite the case law in regards to the amortization period. If you'd like me to share with you the memorandums from Mantle and Wessel, I just think it is a different path to go down. I think it is a wrong path to go down. What I shared with the people before was something to the effect, sexually oriented businesses should be treated the same as other businesses within the state of Oregon. That's what we attempted to do by the zoning regulation. We didn't require cities and counties to do it. We haven't done anything like that. All we're saying is that they may choose to do that. The League of Oregon Cities is on board. All kinds of cities across the state are on board with this resolution. If the concern of this committee is that they're going to be unfairly sectioned out, you could look at language, something like sexually oriented businesses may not be subject to more restrictive non-conforming use or amortization regulations than those applicable to other similarly situated businesses. That would accomplish the same type of thing without creating a whole second tier of businesses and zoning regulations within the bounds of the Constitution. They should be treated equally and fairly as other similarly situated businesses. Bars don't have these protections. Other types of businesses don't have these protections that are currently out there. We're leveling the playing field here, just as other states have done.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add,
yes,
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go back to a comment that Mr. Patridge made that I must respectfully disagree with. And the whole purpose behind the -15 is because these types of businesses will end up being targeted. That's the whole rationale. I mean, that's the reason why this HCR is in front of you, is that there's a lot of concern in local communities about these types of businesses. And I think they will get special attention. I think they will get attention different than what you might see in the zoning arena for your neighborhood grocery store or your gas station. It's just the very nature of the content of the business that we're talking about here. I think it's naive to suggest that they won't get special attention at the local level. This amendment simply extends to existing businesses that were lawfully set up in the state and that are currently in existence or will be in existence at the time this measure is voted on. To suggest that, you know, this is just like any other business, it isn't. We know that this is the type of business that tends to generate, you know, fairly strong emotions on all sides of the debate.
Mr. Chair, are you saying that under Representative Patridge's approach, which is, you know, putting in a requirement that they not be treated with discrimination, that they're treated like similar situated businesses, are you saying that under that kind of criterion, it would be too hard to get damages if they were discriminated against?
Mr. Murphy Burdick, I don't honestly know if it would be too difficult for them to get damages in that situation. All I know is that, you know, this one sentence in Section 2 in the -815, this one sentence just would simply serve to provide that these existing businesses would not be affected by the passage of this measure. And this measure also does give us an opportunity to resolve this issue, which we've already gone through two elections on. And I think that, you know, it's fairly, you know, I don't view it as a huge concession to put this grandparenting clause in here. And I think it will make for a less contentious election when this does go to the voters.
Other comments? I am on the -15 added the word lawfully between is and in.
On line
4. So it says the section does not apply to sexually oriented businesses that business that is lawfully in existence in this state on the table. And just a final question, I presume if we have the new subsection 3, then we have codified or constitutionalized a 2-year abandonment standard, whereas if it wasn't there, then it would be back to case law. Is that your understanding as far as what abandonment would be?
Yeah, sure. I Andrea Meyer, I studied Oregon. It's my understanding, I may be incorrect, that it is left up to cities and counties and their ordinances, and the concern to address here is that those counties and cities are going to have a lot of pressure after and if this is passed by those proponents of laws like this who actually want to eradicate them entirely. And it can't be done under the First Amendment, which is the standard adopted. So there's going to be a lot of pressure.
Your concern is the county or city could then come in and say you're considered to have discontinued business if you don't operate for a period of 30 days.
We're concerned that it opens up the door to county and city zoning ordinances that will be a reaction and to quicken and hasten the demise of lots of businesses that are sexually oriented versus non-sexually oriented considering non-conforming use.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I think that these types of businesses are allowed to be regulated through zoning ordinances in 48 other states besides Oregon and Hawaii. They exist and thrive in those states. To say that these are going to be unfairly targeted or even think that the cities of Oregon have the ability to amortize or condemn these types of businesses and purchase them up, I think is a strong scare tactic and leap, and I don't think that it's reasonable. There's the city coffers do not have the ability. If you're looking at, for example, the city of Nyssa right now, they've got over 250 complaints in the city of Nyssa. They're worried they can't even hire their city. They can't pay the fees for their city attorney to fight the court case, even if we had this kind of case on the book. So I think it's a little ridiculous to say we're going to go out. That there's going to be all kinds of amortization and condemnation of these types of businesses. This allows for slow, reasonable, planned growth without being too cheap.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just make sure I understand what your intent is in adding the word lawfully in line 4. Lawfully would not extend to the fact that these would be non-conforming uses. In other words, lawfully would relate more to this is a business that's been lawfully incorporated, established, set up, et cetera. I mean, I'm concerned that it could be, someone could misinterpret that to say, well, you're a non-conforming use, therefore you're not lawful.
No, and that wasn't my intent. My concern was you'd have a business that is in existence right now but may not be a lawful non-conforming use. And it's in existence. Have we then grandfathered in a business that we didn't intend to?
Okay. And that's not our intent.
Okay.
Can
I give you an example of that? I mean, if it's a conforming use now and then it's non-conforming after the amendment, what would be an example of what you're talking about?
Let's say there's a business that's open right now. Mm-hmm. And there's a contest going on as to whether or not that is a lawful use going on in that particular area. And I can't give you an example, but the fact that we say it's in existence and not lawful, technically we grandfathered in that system. It may be in violation of something right now. That was my concern. Pretty small concern, but that was the reason I was toying with that.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
is Mark going to testify on this at all? I'd like to hear her comment. I don't want to move everybody out. It's just here because it all fits in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafoury. I represent the City of Portland. I am not a lawyer, and I don't intend to play one today. But the way I look at this amendment, there is a substantial difference in my mind between a zoning code protection and a constitutional protection for grandfathering. The ACLU says that this does not give existing businesses special status, but I think it does because this is a constitutional provision that is a special status that other businesses do not enjoy. We oppose this amendment. If the dash 15 is put into HJR 52, the City of Portland will publicly oppose the constitutional amendment. I think this is a poison pill for the constitutional amendment, and I would urge you to set it aside.
Yes, there is, though, a constitutional protection for these kind of businesses right now.
Yes, there is, Mr. Chairman, so they do have special status that would ever be extended to them.
But what, to some extent, by passing this 52, they would lose that constitutional protection.
I don't see that exactly with the grandfathering that would be afforded to the constitutional grandfathering that would be afforded to existing businesses.
But they wouldn't with the constitutional grandfathering, but if you deleted that, you just had an opposition to 815, then that protection would be eliminated. Correct?
Then they would be on the same standing as other businesses.
And they lose current constitutional protection.
Which makes them different.
You can go back to ballot measure. The ballot measure thing.
Then
they had greater protection than they would have that ballot measure passed.
Absolutely.
So this would continue for the existing ones what they have now.
That's right. That's right.
Someone else would like this.
My name is Beth Vargas. I'm from the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities has been in support of HDR 52, again, in light of A15. I agree with the items as outlined by Marge. One thing I'd like to add, and Senator Brown had made comments here previously about prior measures, and it's my understanding that those measures would have impacted more content with these businesses, and I think it's important to note that HDR 52 is only striving to affect the zoning of these businesses, does not impact the content at all, of thereby not really reaching the First Amendment in that respect, only in light of the zoning. I'd like to note that difference.
Yeah, I think it's understood. Other questions? Committee, why don't we end the work session on this today, and we'll bring it back next week. End the work session on HDR. What time do you go back? Maybe before we go to the next, well, I want to remind everyone that we'll meet again at 2:30 this afternoon on HJR 87 through 94.
Okay, about an hour.
I don't think it'll take that long.
Okay.
But my guess is it'll take about 3 minutes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Turner would like to take up 2758.
I'll move this bill out here, Mr. Chair.
All right.
If that's what people want to do.
Before we move the bill, Senator Tarno, I did invite the people to complete their testimony. So if we could do that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2758 and Corey. And John Baker. And also Phil Donovan. If you recall, today we ran out of time on Tuesday, and I'd asked Mr. Corey a question that asked his attorney to be allowed to come and testify, so that's why we're going to
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffori. I appreciate the courtesy shown me this morning. I'd like to introduce my guest, John Baker, who is both an architect and a lawyer and practices in that field. And as an officer of the Oregon Council of Architects, has been giving us legal advice on this and drafted the Dash 4 amendments, which I'm asking to be placed in 2758. At the suggestion, as I may remind the committee, of Lane Shetterly, Representative Lane Shetterly in the House Chair, didn't have time to deal with our House bill and suggested that we put it into this bill. The underlying 2758 has to do with a battle going on between people that we have no interest in and no quarrel with. Whatever they choose to do in their bill and their battles is interesting to us only at a distance. And I'd like Mr. Baker to explain, ask any questions about our amendments and explain why we ought to have our amendments added to this bill.
Thank you. When we last talked to Mr. Corey, I wanted to discuss whether or not these are just technical changes or if there are any substantive changes in the statute. And that's where we got both ran out of time and we're bogged down a little bit. So as you address the Dash A4s, if you comment on that, that would be helpful. Before you do that, I want to recognize that we have three students from the governor's conference on student leaders or something like that. What's the title, Matthew? The Oregon Governor's School at Willamette University. So one of them happens to be from Bend, Oregon, so he gets special recognition.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make an apology to the students. I wish that we were talking about the stretch bill instead of the construction lien bill. It might not be that much fun.
Yes, but I'm sure this will seem, they'll probably go home and say, well, they're really going for a while. But Baker.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and the committee, and thank you for your patience in inviting me to speak this morning. I'm here to speak in support of this bill, and I think I'll get directly to the question that the chair has asked me, which is this represent substantive changes to the lien laws? I do not believe that it does. The intention of the bill as drafted to go through is simply to put into place some procedural elements that were missing from the statute as the design professionals' liens were added in the early and mid-80s. Design professional liens were specifically added in, but only at the beginning of the statute, clearly creating lien rights for design professionals for design services on projects and actually creating a right for design services on unbuilt projects in the amendments in 1981. But the problem being that all the notice provisions and timing provisions in the statute as they're written now, which persisted after these amendments, didn't make any accommodation for the design professionals' liens. So for the most part, what these amendments attempt to do is to either adjust some of that language or add specific provisions that are pertinent with respect to the time of filing liens, the time that notice might be filed, and how the lien works with respect most specifically to unbuilt projects that might where you might have design professional liens. So the short answer to that question is no, this does not represent substantive change.
How are surveyors, architects, engineers disadvantaged now under the current law?
In that the procedures for filing their lien, when their lien should be filed, and how the lien is taken care of in terms of the timing, when notices should be given, as it stands right now, the design professionals obligation to give a notice if it's working for the agent for someone other than the owner and believes that it has a lien, it's required to give a notice. But if one applies the notice provisions that are in the statute now, it wouldn't be required to give the notice until a contractor began construction, and it would be more appropriate to give that notice earlier. What it comes down to is it's unclear when he should give notice or how to give the notice. It also is unclear when the design professional should file a lien. As it stands right now, the design professional's lien purportedly persists until 75 days after construction is complete. That wouldn't matter whether the architect stopped giving services a year and a half before that when it did the design, and the construction's complete a year and a half later. What these issues in the statute now do, I think, to the design professional is they lead to a lot of unclarity. It's not reasonable to presume that an architect's got a lien that lasts that long under the statute, and any time that as a legal professional I'm advising design professionals about filing liens, I have to tell them that it is not absolutely clear when and how they're supposed to file their lien under the statute, because the statute is more particularly directed to the construction trades. So they're disadvantaged in that any time a design professional files a lien, the design professional risks erroneously filing the lien or filing an invalid lien. And the repercussions of attempting to foreclose an invalid lien, no matter how good the underlying debt, is that that design professional becomes liable to pay the attorney fees of the owner of the property. Also, it tends to put into question and begs an architect or an engineer to improperly file a lien because of the lack of clarity. And in that case, it would be inviting architects and engineers to file liens against property that they shouldn't be filing against, and that also prejudices the owners of the property to have that kind of lack of clarity. So by sharpening the edges and making the procedures clear, I think it protects both the design professional and the homeowner from erroneously filing liens.
Three other questions. Under current law, isn't it that you have to file the lien 75 days after the construction is complete, or 75 days since you've last performed labor, whichever is earlier?
That is correct for the classes of liens that apply to contractors, but that is not correct as the statute exists now with respect to architects. The only reference to time is 75 days from substantial completion.
So it's actually, under current law, an advantage to an engineer or architect because a general contractor or subcontractor has a shorter period if, in fact, he or she provided labor, stopped providing labor 75 days. You have to file your lien within 75 days of your last labor.
Arguably, yes, it's a tremendous advantage to design professionals in that it purportedly gives them a lien that persists far, far after they do their work and far, far after they stop doing their work, potentially because on an unbuilt project, presumably on this, if an architect performs services, that lien persists and can be perfected at any time if that owner or even a subsequent owner begins construction of that project 2, 3, 5 years hence. And suddenly the lien would arise. That's what the statute says would occur. I don't believe that a court would interpret the statute that way, and the trouble is I don't really know how a court would interpret the statute in those kind of circumstances.
Another area that page 6 is actually the old language.
Yes.
And is this any change in the existing law as far as the relationship between the owner and the agent?
I don't believe that it is. What this is intended to do is to put the same burden on the design professional that is on a contractor that is working for a tenant on a piece of property, which is if you intend to file this lien, which the notice provision requires, that you get this notice out. What it does is it provides the architect the same protection that the contractor has under the notice provision by clarifying and establishing that if the owner is not authorizing, or in other words, if the person for whom the architect is not working is not the agent of the owner, and that the architect's services don't arise in a lien, that the architect gets notice of that. And at that point, presumably, the architect can reconsider what his options are as to whether he's going to be paid for these services or not. And it also provides the owner the opportunity to disavow the agency before the commitment has been made and the services have been rendered.
And does this have a law today? I know it is for contractors.
It is for contractors.
What's the law for?
There isn't any part of the statute that says with respect to architects one way or the other.
Has that ever been litigated or gone through the...
Not that I'm aware of.
And then the final thing, you added supervision as a legal provision, where before that wasn't included. What is the purpose in doing that? Why wouldn't the existing language of services provide that?
It probably would. When we added the word supervision, it was because at ORS 870105, where they define what constitutes professional services, included in that is one who supervises the construction. And it was really that other changes just to bring it into being consistent, including all the services that are delineated in the enabling part of the statute, to just make it consistent at the back end. It wasn't to create anything new. And that's why the word.
In my experience with architects and engineers, there's always been a contract, too, usually a standard AIA contract, which delineates the services. So that's taken care of. On page 8, you change the word allowed to allocate on line 13.
Yes, and that was done in response to the last, I believe it was two sessions ago, the attorney fee statute was changed. And when it was changed away from base because there was case law that had said that when a lien claimant forecloses a lien claim against an owner. If the lien claimant prevails on the validity and the collection receipts on the lien, the claimant was able to recover attorney fees as part of its costs in the litigation. What that resulted in through case law was that when a lien claimant had a valid claim for payment but lost on the lien, the owner who was being sued, who owed the money to the contractor in that case, did not recover attorney fees under the statute because the owner wasn't the prevailing party. So what happened in those cases is the court said neither party gets attorney fees because the contractor can't avail itself of the statute because it didn't prevail on the lien, but the owner can't prevail under the statute because the owner's not the prevailing party in the case, which was a reasonably equitable result, but there were some homeowners that didn't like it. And so it was changed, and the new language was intended to make it so that if the wrongful lien is filed, regardless of what the issue is with respect to who recovers, who's the prevailing party in the case, the owner is going to be able to recover the fees for the wrongful lien, for the invalid lien. With the way it is written right now, there is one case in which I am aware of which did not go to trial, in which the owner, the contractor, filed a lien for many millions of dollars over a dispute in which the contractor had valid claims for payment, but the lien was found to be invalid, actually by an arbitrator in arbitration based on contract language in the contract. And so when the lien was withdrawn and the foreclosure was dismissed based on the arbitrator's result, the owner turned around and attempted to recover the attorney fees from the prevailing contractor, from the contractor who was still entitled to be paid, just didn't have a lien, to the tune of about $500,000, because they said what this statute said is you get all your attorney fees in the dispute, even if you don't prevail in the dispute. And the reason to make that language change was to alleviate the court from having to argue with that, and that the court would then allocate the fees based upon the attorney fees, based upon the lien foreclosure as opposed to the whole case. Because I don't believe under the rules as they're written now that the court really has power to do that kind of allocation. Attorney fees are considered parts of costs, and the court is directed under the rules to award reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing party.
and then Court of Appeals case came down in 98 arguing a change in the law on how you determine who the prevailing party is, which has created great confusion, not only in this but in other areas.
More confusion, for certain. And it seems that it is, if the legislature decided that it was appropriate that one filing a lien take the risk, the attorney fees risk, that if you have made a mistake, because liens are fraught with technical difficulties, it is very likely when one files an attempt to foreclose a lien that there is going to be at least one technical defense raised, usually more than one, and that one always runs the risk that one's made a mistake, misinterpreted what the final day was, misinterpreted what the 75th day was. There's lots of people, because people file their own liens. And it's just very, very easy to make a mistake. And when one goes to foreclose the lien, you find out about the mistake that it's fairly substantial peril, especially if it's small amounts.
And usually the attorney is given the lien on the 74th or the 75th day.
If he is given the, if he gets to not see the lien after it's been recorded in the 75 days of run, yes.
Why don't we have Mr. Donovan?
Mr. Chairman, may I just make one comment before that?
Yep.
The opponents of our amendments, the people who are sponsors of the underlying bill, have made the suggestion to the committee that we just let this go through unamended and that there be a work group through the interim and that these people hassle out their difficulties. And I have two comments to make on that suggestion. Number one, I don't see any reason why attorneys should have to wait, why architects should have to wait another 2 years, minimally another 2 years, while we still can't get our liens because they have a problem they can't work out. That seems grossly unfair to me. And secondly, I spent some time through this interim just working with Mr. Baker and another lawyer who represents engineers, which is not that different an occupation, and we spent 5 or 6 hours and came up with absolutely nothing in terms of trying to do some modification of the lien laws. The expectation that you're going to get 4 or 5 or 6 different parties all with different interests in a room and that somehow in 2 years they're going to come up with agreement on what the lien laws ought to be in the state, I think is highly optimistic. And Mr. Baker suggested to me that he thinks 4 years is a lot more realistic time which this could all be put together. And so what you've done during that hiatus is asked us to step back and hold off our lien rights for 4 years while these other people hassle out what their issues are. And we just don't think that's right, Mr. Chair. So we would ask that we, the our amendment in this bill, let them fight their battles separately. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, one of the reasons that this was before us is because you had your lien concerns in House Bill 2991, and for some reason that missed the deadline or something. What happened?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, what happened was we brought the bill in. The bill had a section there relating to surveyors' liens. It was suggested by the House committee that the surveyors' liens not be placed in this section of the bill, that they be placed in another section of the bill. You're going to see that bill next week. It passed the Senate pertaining only to surveyors' liens. It puts in another part of the statute, not in the construction lien statute, puts in the miscellaneous lien statute.
In response to your comments, it's my hope during the interim that Representative Shetterly and myself share an interim judiciary committee. And I've stayed away generally from lien law issues in my 6 years because they do become so contentious. But Representative Shetterly and I have decided to add that to the interim judiciary committee to take a look at certain aspects of it because in addition to this, there's other issues that have come up, and we probably should explore those again. Not an enviable task, but it's not.
If I just may finish the question, the answer to the question, Mr. Chair. By the time the amendments came back and we had the bill, then other objections were raised, and you've seen those objections as they were passed out to you. We consider those objections to be frivolous objections. We don't think they're substantive at all. Mr. Baker can respond to them individually if you want. The committee didn't think they were substantive. Mr. Shetterly didn't think they were substantive. I had the votes on the committee to pass our bill, 2661, but by that time the deadline had run and we couldn't get a work session scheduled. So that's when Mr. Shetterly said, my suggestion to you is to get on 2758 because after all, they're two separate issues and there shouldn't be a problem with it.
that's why we're bringing the amendment to you.
Mr. Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil Donovan representing the Oregon Equipment Rental Association. We're opposed to the proposed Dash 4 amendments, and we take exception to the notion that these amendments only affect architects. The amendment affects all lane claimants, including rental companies, by adding new undefined words. Notice provisions are being modified, as Mr. Baker spoke to. And there's language that's contradictory to past legislative history, on which actually Mr. Chair, you alluded to. On page 4, line 20, constructed improvements, the word constructed is added. The addition of constructed affects rental companies and contractors and throws into question what is an improvement, which is currently understood, which is materials being delivered to a site, labor commencing, and what is a constructed improvement, which is not understood. For my client, it is critical to avoid that rental companies only have a priority on a lien when an improvement is completed. On page 3, line 10, notice of a right to a lien is not required during progress of an improvement. This is different from all other notices. Are other professionals, such as engineers, affected by this change? The concern on this one is that the balance of construction lien law is being changed without consensus of affected parties, and it's creating, in effect, a new exemption, which is a big concern of the work group for the interim, is how are these exemptions handled. With regards to language as contradictory to past legislative history, the term of professional service and supervision versus service, which is currently understood, is a great concern. And I actually brought a transcript from 1987 which I'll distribute to the committee that talks about what the different categories are of construction lanes, and that service is already understood. The technical matters, frankly, are better laid out in the handout that I've distributed to the committee and prior hearings. Thank you. But I'd just like to close with stating that the concerns of the Architects Council can be taken care of during the interim committee. And I would disagree that House Bill 2991, the statement that we didn't have substantive problems with that bill. We did. We presented those. And I would disagree respectfully that the votes were there to move that bill out of committee. So with that, I would close. I would also note, though, that I'm not up here in a vacuum by myself. You've also heard from the Associated General Contractors, the Associated Builders and Contractors, and the bankers. So I hate to monopolize their time, but at your discretion, Mr. Chair.
We do have their letter in opposition to the Dash 4 amendment. Are there questions for Mr. Donovan? Thank you for your testimony this morning. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Chair, could Mr. Baker respond to the allegations that somehow our amendments
very briefly?
Just to do them in order, I think one of them is the word constructed. Commencement of construction is a defined term, and completion is not implied by construction. Anytime construction has begun, and there's also case law about when construction begins, and construction begins when visible work starts at the site. The trade industries that do the work are not going to have liens unless construction starts. One cannot rent equipment to a project unless construction starts, because that would be defined as construction. I tried one case in which the moving of the equipment onto the site was what the court found was the commencement of construction, the day the first piece of equipment moved onto the site. That was a constructed project at that point. I don't think that there is any confusion. I already addressed with you the issue about services, that word comes from the enabling part of the statute. And is certainly understood and is fact defined in the statute. These sections do not implicate or impact these other trades in any way.
Thank you for your testimony. questions or comments concerning House Bill 1258, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4 amendments, A4 amendments.
Senator Brown moves the dash A4 amendments. Discussion.
Mr.
I'll just some idea that I think it's a very complicated area. There seems to have been a negotiated agreement amongst these folks and for us to come at this point to try and change it. And the chair seems to want to take this on during the interim.
Well, reluctantly, this and other issues. I have talked to the other parties who were the sponsors of the original bill. They indicate that with the A4 amendments, they would oppose their own bill or try to get it changed in the conference committee. So that complicates things further. Generally, on amendments to bills, sometimes I'll accept amendments that aren't offered by the sponsors. I do believe that the A4 offers some clarification and some validity. I think after listening to the testimony, I don't want to add them at this time to the bill. I'll take a look at it in the interim. That would be my choice. So I'll also be on that.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm not opposed. I mean, I don't pretend to understand all the intricacies of it, but it did appear from a process standpoint that there was a lot of work that went into a consensus solution to this, and then the other people with the dash 4 amendments might have some very legitimate things they're trying to address, but it doesn't seem to fit. So if they could find another vehicle that we could look at separately, that might be a better way to do it.
Mr. Chair, given that I can count, I will withdraw my motion.
Senator Tarno.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill before due pass recommendation.
Senator Tarno moves House Bill 2758 before due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection, support? And Tarno, we can raise
that. I'll give you a whirl, Mr. Chair.
All right, Roll, no one can
hear you.
To the committee, I make my mind up a little sooner, but I wanted to hear the bill and hear the discussion because it'll also help me in deciding what I want to do in the interim. And I also hope at some point the parties might come to some consensus on it, but I came to the conclusion that wasn't going to happen. And the bill would be in jeopardy. Well, now I return to our work session on House Bill 2805. And there were a couple questions that were raised last time, and I believe Ann went to get legislative council staff answer one of those. We have in front of you today some additional amendments that were discussed.
Is Representative Stringer being called?
Yes, he is.
Thank you.
Here he is.
So, I'll let you put that schedule back.
I'm not going to do that for you.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You have questions, questions.
I think that you are going to address the amendments that I think they were the dash AA thing with the New York Times standard. Is that correct? I lost them. That's why I'm stumbling.
The AA's, I believe, are the New York Times.
Right.
Right. And we also have for you this morning the A12 amendment with regard to prevailing parties.
And the punitive damages.
Right.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, A12, Dan, or A11 that you're looking at?
A.
Well, we also have the A10s, which were my amendments from last time.
And then there's 12 and 13. And the 12 are prevailing parties, attorney fees and costs, and then the 13s are, and then the 12 are those fees and costs plus punitive damages.
And I'll talk on the punitive damages issue myself in just a moment. I don't have the 11th on it.
You do?
I don't.
The 11th, was that the one where it was typical but mandatory that they be awarded? I think that's probably true.
The 11th deal with F6.
Chair Brian, if I may be assistant, Dave Hendrickson, Legislative Council's office. The A11 amendments were prepared for Senator Carnell and address punitive, basically convey reciprocity for the attorney's fees, but eliminate the provision relating to punitive damages. So it's a variation on what also appears in the A12 and A13 amendments.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I suggest that we not deal with the A11, but instead deal with the, if we want this approach to deal with the A12, because the only difference is that the A11s make the attorney fees mandatory for both sides, and the A12s make it discretionary but allows it for both sides. And the supporters of this legislation feel that if you're going to go with reciprocity, it would be better to have it be discretionary with the judge.
All right. The issue on the attorney's fee portion also is of concern for the chair. For the four sessions I have been in the legislature, I have always fought for, if they're going to be awarded attorney's fees, they should go to the prevailing party and not just picking one side or the other. And so as legislation's gone through judiciary, I think that's a very clear policy that we need to have. Because certainly in this instance, if you're a defendant and you prevail, I have no problem with the defendants recovering at reasonable attorney's fees at the court's discretion. Likewise, if in turn the plaintiff does prevail under the new standard, they should be able to recover their attorney's fees too. So it needs to be reciprocal, and that's consistent with the legislation we passed in 1995 in the Tort Reform Act. So that part of it, I hope we are in agreement. I'd agree that it can be made so that it is the discretion of the court. I like the court having discretion. Then, on the issue of punitive damages, in 1995, we changed the law dealing with punitive damages. Punitive damages are not intended to be compensatory damages for someone. They're designed to offer punishment. Most of the money goes to the state of Oregon, I think the victim's fund, and the portion then goes to the attorney, and then there's a small portion that goes to the person who receives the award. David, do you remember what the exact percentages are?
It's 60% now to the victim's compensation fund, 40% to the victim, of which I believe there's a cap of 20% of which can go to the attorney. I think that's how the breakdown is.
That's
a cap
the question on my reference.
Yeah, there's a cap on how much can go to the attorney.
All right. And what are the criteria, David, for punitive damages under current law?
Well, the statute doesn't indicate, of course, in case law, the courts have always held that, you know, you have to show some outrageousness. You have to have something that's worthy of being punished. And that's where punitive damages have always come into play. The classic example I always give for authority for an awarding of punitive damages is if you have a accident at an intersection with two cars and the other person was negligent, you'll be able to sue them and get your damages. If the other person was negligent and drunk, the courts are going to be quite happy to award punitive damages because they're going to say that's beyond your negligence. You did something really bad, and so it's worthy of an award of punitive damages.
Then also under the procedure we set up for 1995, in order to receive punitive damages, you had to petition the court, show a prima facie evidence before you could proceed with that claim. The reason for doing that was we found that it was tactical advantage when bringing a lawsuit to allege punitive damages that causes on the other side, whether it be plaintiff or defendant, to hire a second legal counsel, to because one would represent you on the basic claim, one on the punitive damage claim. If insurance was involved, the insurance would cover it. Also, it exposed the party who had a punitive damage claim to go through a great deal of discovery about personal tax returns, personal wealth, and it became, rather than a shield, a weapon to force a settlement. So that was one of the things we corrected in 1995. So I'm very reluctant to cut out now a new exception dealing with punitive damages. The parties in this instance could apply under the existing law without creating a new cause of action. Also, David, you thought there would be a constitutional problem dealing with punitive damages?
Senator Bryan, I was asked about reciprocity, about having provision that indicated that either party could acquire punitive damages in an action under this section. And the problem with that is, since this action, this particular statute addresses basically defamation actions, there was a Supreme Court case from, I believe, the 70s, Wheeler versus Green, that indicated that you could not award punitive damages to a plaintiff in a defamation action. And that was a constitutional decision based on the First Amendment and freedom of speech, in which basically the court said, we recognize defamation as a longstanding common law action and one where you can sue someone for their speech in order to recover damages for injury to your reputation, but when you go to punitive damages, you're punishing them for their speech, and that runs into problems underneath the free speech rights. So reciprocity for punitive damages in the bill would, you know, if you put it in, probably would have constitutional difficulty.
And of course, what we passed in 95 was statutory, wouldn't affect that constitutional decision.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry for the interruption. To get to the chairman's point about the punitive damages being available under our existing system, in order to file for punitive damages, wouldn't the defendant in the lawsuit have to file a cross complaint and become the plaintiff?
Senator Bryan, Senator Burdick, you're correct. The language in this bill came from a model bill, and I hate to use that as any sort of an excuse, I won't, but it's very strange to be awarding damages to a defendant in an action, because damages are awarded to someone who's filed a complaint against the other party saying, I'm entitled to recover damages. Unless it was a cross-claim of some sort in the action, it would be. I could see ways in looking at it that could be gotten around. For instance, I could imagine a defendant in one of these actions asserting this defense under the bill if it's now drafting, filing their answer in a lawsuit saying, I was immune underneath this section, and here's a cross-claim for punitive damages that's authorized under this statute. But it is a little bit different, because it's basically just creating a statutory claim for punitive damages for the defendant, and it's a little bit out of the ordinary from what we have now in the average civil action between parties.
So, Mr. Chairman, yes, follow up. So, without specific authorization, it would be correct to say that a defendant could not file for punitive damages?
Chair Bryan, Senator Burke, that is correct. There is no authority in the existing law for a defendant without attaching a claim for punitive damage to some other action. You know, punitives are attack on set of damages. We don't have causes of action, statutory causes of action, say you can just sue someone for punitive damages.
In fact, case law didn't allow that prior either. You had to have a substantive cause of action in order to attach punitive. In this type of thing, though, this type of defense, you could attach a substantive claim if you wanted to, and then raise the issue with the court under current law whether or not you're entitled to punitive damages. So you'd have to have a substantive claim also.
You'd have to file a cross claim and become the plaintiff. And so if you are trying to achieve the goal of reciprocity, you can't in this case because of the First Amendment constraints. You cannot allow a plaintiff to have the same punitive damages rights because of the Wheeler versus Green Supreme Court decision. Is that correct?
Chair Bryan, that's the problem, yes, and that's a correct statement of the issue.
Thank you.
So the plaintiff can't file a punitive damage claim, the defendant could, under existing law, if you attach it to another subsequent.
If they file the cross claim.
Right. And that's our existing law, and that is what we attempted to do, I think, in 95. Other questions? Well, what the chair would move, then, first of all, would be the -810 amendment to House Bill 2805. This deals with the issue of the immunity conveyed does not apply if the statement is not material in any issue being considered by the public, and the person making the statement knew or should have known that the statement was false at the time the statement was made. -810.
Thank you. That's true.
Discussion on the 810.
Well, Mr. Chair, you talked about the possibility of better defining that should have known.
And that is defined in current case law. That standard is there.
Standard is there.
Is already.
In other words, it's not, as a layman, you look at that, and I'm really bothered by it. But you say it's well established as far as case law goes.
Yeah.
What one of my concerns is just an ordinary citizen will know about this law, but will they understand they should have known?
And it's something that...
Should have known, you know, it's kind of...
It's something that the plaintiff would have to prove, also, that they should have known. A reasonable and prudent person should have known.
My concern is scaring someone off from testifying legitimately, worrying that they might make an error someplace and say something that is wrong and that they should have known. They would know. But you're assuring me that it's okay.
I'm assuring you that there are standards that are set. And what the chair was trying to do here was balance the public policy and need to have people testify. And at the same time, not have someone to avoid responsibility for lying, closing their ears, closing their eyes, not doing some reasonable due diligence before they make their statement in these very important hearings. Because there's another phrase used occasionally in tort law, and it's called innocent simpleton. That, and
please describe.
May I ask a stupid question? If line 5 were to read that the person making the statement knew that the statement was false at the time, that might alleviate some of our comfort levels. The should have known language makes me extremely uncomfortable.
But you see, I want to place a burden on the person, a reasonable burden to explore the facts before they make a statement.
But aren't we talking about citizens here who are just trying to get involved in the public process?
Oh, and that? Yes, but even being a citizen, I think, requires that type of responsibility. Your other option is to take out the word material in Section A so that it covers both, in the original bill, both material and immaterial. Which would be my preference, but this is my effort to find a compromise.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
if I could direct a question to the counsel here, the should have known criterion is a bar. Is that a very high bar in case law in cases like this?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, the should have known language. I mean, to say that the person knew can be a hard thing to prove in trial because, you know, the vagaries of people's knowledge. I mean, you know, to say, yes, this person acted, but the only way you're going to get that is perhaps with a statement by them. I know this isn't true, but the should have known basically allows the person trying to show that the person should have known, to show that there was a series of facts that this person read this letter beforehand that indicated it wasn't true, you know, it's going to allow introduction of a lot of these outside facts to show that there was enough circumstances that the jury, in looking at the issue, where it's going to be able to say, well, we can't say for absolute certainty that this person knew it, but boy, they should have, because of all the totality of facts that the plaintiff has brought in here and set before us to show that, they had every opportunity to know this and should have known.
Okay, of course, and that's, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, that's kind of the whole point here is that it's a jury determination, and the whole purpose of this legislation is to keep as many cases as possible from getting to that stage, but to discourage the filing of these types of lawsuits unless the situation is very extreme. So I also have concern about this amendment, but I also believe that with the protection of the materiality, it's not going to be a huge inroad into it, but I would prefer that we not limit it in this way.
I understand your concern, but if you just say no, that's almost an impossible burden, because the defendant then can say, well, I didn't know, and then you've got to find some way to show that they did. And even if with the should have known, the burden is still on the plaintiff.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You know, I raised the question because of a bit of discomfort with it. I recognize the legal terminology is different on it. I want to be sure we have a 2805,
mm-hmm.
And I'm going to follow the lead of the chair. I have great confidence in him, but well, wanting to get on the record my discomfort with that should have known business. I just don't want to lose the whole thing.
Thank you. Other discussion then on the dash 810. Are there objections to the 810s? Please record three objections.
Object.
Senator Courtney, Senator Brown, Senator Burdick. Motion carried. The chair then would move the...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I was going to move to go to the dash, the next amendment.
I'm sorry. Okay, at the appropriate time, I would like an opportunity to move the dash 812.
All right. If I could make a suggestion to the 812. The chair would support the 812 with the elimination of the last sentence beginning on page 6 that says the court may award punitive damages to a defendant who prevails in a civil action by reason of the immunity conveyed by this section. For the reasons stated earlier, I think we should stay with our existing statutory scheme on punitive damages. They're still available for the defendant, but I do not want to create a special exception to the current law on punitive.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that would be the A13 amendment, which says that.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Those would be the chair's preference. So let me try it this way and see how the votes fly. The chair would move the dash A13 amendments, House Bill 2805. Discussion. Objection.
Right here.
Objection.
Right here.
We have three objections. Again, please note that Senator Courtney, Senator Brown, and Senator Burdick object. Motion carries. The chair then would move HB 2805 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would register my objection and also send you this to the minority report.
Okay, do that right after we take the vote.
You didn't want to forget.
Your one sentence. Objection. We have Senator Brown, Senator Courtney, Senator Burdick objecting to the amended bill. Motion carries. Senator Brown registers notice of possible minority report, and she is joined by Senator Burdick.
Uh-oh.
Senator Courtney. Noted.
We're going to have fun on this one.
That we are. We are in recess at 2:30 this afternoon. Also at 2:30, we should have the amendments for House Bill 3388.
Oh, okay.